I'll just explain what you've got in your hands. I think one or two more might turn up. I'm a therapist. I particularly specialise in helping people with chronic anxiety or anything related to that, because sometimes people don't want to call it anxiety. But that feeling you have that something bad's going to happen all the time, that's anxiety in whatever form, shape or whatever. I've also recently helped people with depression and so on. I tend to work in one session and I make major changes, so it's a breakthrough session. But I'm also available for people who just can't deal with what's happening in their life at the moment. And for that I just do an hourly sort of, one hour session, and we'll see how it goes from there. But usually there's a lot I can fit in an hour. It's a very quick, I don't do counselling, it's a lot faster than that, because I'm actually looking at the core problem all the time. And I deal with the core problem and it seems to knock everything else out of the way of it. About 2 weeks ago, I had somebody came with five different problems. And she went, oh, you won't deal with this in one session, I've got all these five problems. And when I looked at them, it always came to the same thing. It's a lack of self-worth. And when people have a lack of self-worth, something has triggered that off. And so I'm always looking for, well, what's the first time that something happened that made you feel that you weren't worthy? And when I find that and destroy it, then it actually changes the whole life. It's almost like that thing didn't happen. It's a lovely thing to see, because people change almost instantly. So I have a few hours with them, but there's one point in that session where you just see them change and they get taller and more confident and everything. And the anxiety just leaves. Depression is a bit more complex than that, because it lingers on a bit, because depression is about not dealing with stuff. So anxiety is looking out for stuff so that you can see it before it happens, so that it won't hurt you. But depression is, I don't want to hear about it. It's sort of like keep everybody out, and you go into that dark place, and that's supposed to be sort of rest for you, but it's not, because it's a horrible place to be. But that's what it's intended for. And if people haven't actually learned how to deal with things, then when I take the depression away, they've still got the thing that things happen that they can't deal with. So then it's a little bit, just a bit longer that they need help for, because then they need to build up these skills of dealing with things that we've all learnt over the years, but people with depression haven't, because they've blocked everything out, just with the I can't cope sort of idea. So that's the sort of work I do. Inside the brochure that you've got is a prize draw card. If you'd like to fill that in, you can get 50% off a session with me. You can even transfer it to a friend if you've got a friend in need who might benefit from my work. Or you get a free CD of an issue of your choice. And it's just a CD you would put on at night and just listen to as you go to sleep. And it actually talks to your unconscious mind to release the problem that you have. That's what I do. Okay. It's very unique the way I work, and there's a lot of humour and everything in it. So, yes, it's not a go and pour your heart out and cry your heart out and let's see what happens. It's a go in at one end and you come out the other end, and quite often feeling elated. So it's, in fact, I took somebody only 2 weeks ago and she literally was suicidal. So I asked her a quality of life out of 10, and she gave me a nought, saying she didn't even want to live, but she'd come to me, so I had to fight with her to actually help her for a few hours, and then she finally let me in and I was able to help her, and she left at an 8 out of 10, her own judgment of it, which she said was impossible three, four hours earlier. And in fact, when I went to, I sometimes use hypnosis, I use NLP, I use a thing called energy in motion. And it's all just different ways, just different tools I have of helping people with whatever the problem is. Because it's always about the person in front of me. It's not about, you know, I want to use this or I'll do that when they come. Because what they tell me and what they actually have when they get there are two different things anyway. So I'm not really listening intently on the phone to, oh, it's this, I'll look up, you know, how that works or whatever. It's always something different when they come. And so I just work in the moment, and I'm very intuitive, so I actually deal with things. And I observe people very carefully so that when I'm talking to them, if I mention something, I can see the trigger offer in them that that hurts them or whatever, and I know where we get to. So sometimes people actually don't know what it is that starts all this, and that doesn't matter because I actually find it and then I eliminate it. And some people come along and it's, they think they know what it is and it isn't, it's something else. And sometimes people will come along and they absolutely don't know what it is. And when I take them back to deal with it, what will happen is their unconscious will say, this hurt last time, you know, I don't want to show you it again. And it won't show them or me. Because if it was a moment of terror or whatever when they were younger. And it's quite amazing because when I take people back, when it does show them what it is, sometimes it is the bad thing that they thought it would be. But quite often I take them back and it's quite trivial seen as an adult. But if you think that when you're a child, you're about half the size of everybody else, and if something happens and you suddenly get flooded with an emotion that you don't understand, then it's terrorising for you. And in that moment, you just don't want it to happen again. And this is what sets up anxiety and depression and all sorts of other problems. And that lack of self-worth, we actually just tell ourselves in that moment that we're not worthy, that nobody loves us or whatever. And then we carry that throughout our life. And a few weeks ago I was interviewed for a radio broadcast, and the guy that was asking the questions said, we were talking about having issues in life and dealing with them or not. And he said, so we're given problems so that we can learn from them. And I said, well, no, that's not what I'm saying. When we get issues in our lives, for instance, if you get cancer or something and you recover from it, you're not given cancer to learn the lesson from it. You actually have a problem and you deal with it and then you learn from the problem, but you're not given the problem to learn from it. We just learn from everything in life. And so when we have something that traps us into something that happened in the past but it's still hurting us, it's not that we were made to have a bad, shitty life. It's the very fact that we've learnt the wrong lesson. And when I take people back, it's not usually anything as an adult, because as an adult something happens and you just go, oh, wrong place, wrong time, or whatever. You can logically explain it away, but as a child you can't. And if suddenly this emotion overtakes you for the first time ever and you get locked into it, it's terrifying. But when I take people back and show them what it is, sometimes they go, is that what's messed my life up for 30 years? And it can be really trivial as an adult, but as the child it was horrendous. And probably the best explanation I've got of that one is I had a client who was quite tall, and she'd always been tall for her age as well, and not massively framed or whatever, but big frame. So she would have always felt this sort of ungainly bit that she complained about. And when she went to school, she was also slightly older than most of the other kids, so she was always like this much taller, and it always looked out of place and felt out of place. And at one stage she had this feeling, she felt ungainly and everything else, and her mother bought her a little pink tutu, and she was only about six, and she put this pink tutu on, and it was the first time she'd ever felt good about herself in her life. And so she did a little dance in front of the mirror. And I think she was upstairs, and her mum came in the room, having heard the noise, and she said, what are you doing? You sound like a baby elephant. And that was it. And this screwed this girl's life up for 30 odd years. And when I showed her what it was, she looked at it, and her mum's very sarcastic. I knew her mother, and her mother was a very sarcastic woman. And this was just an ad-lib line that she would just throw away. So her mother wouldn't have meant any hurt by it. It was just a sort of like, just a throwaway line. And I said, what are you going to do now? She said, well, I'm not going to tell my mother because it would hurt her to know that that messed my life up for 30 odd years. And so she never did tell her. And sometimes it can be as trivial as that. I had a guy, I've dealt with a lot of weight loss as well. And a guy came along and they had to do something at school where they stacked benches up and then they had to crawl through the middle of it, just the gym class, and everybody had to do it and they timed them or whatever. And he actually got stuck between the two benches because of his tummy, and the whole class laughed. And that was that screwed his life up for about 40 years. So it's... Well, and the thing was, when I showed him it, I said, and he was like, oh God, yeah, I remember it now. And I said, well, what should we do about it? I said, if you were in the audience, would you have thought, oh, the poor lad, or would you have laughed? And he said, I'd have laughed. I said, so, well, let's have a good laugh about it now then. And just with that, it went. It just disappeared from his life. But we learn all these things throughout life, and then we just sort of, we get the wrong lesson. But we get locked into the wrong lesson. And the trouble is that what you see is what you expect to see. So if we think we're not worthy, we listen out for that in what everybody says to us. And if somebody sort of says anything that sounds like it agrees with us, then we almost smile and go, yeah, I know I'm not worthy. There's almost a, yeah, I thought that as well. And if somebody says something nice to us, we actually get, oh, bugger off, you know, no, I'm not. So somebody says, oh, you're beautiful and you're slim, and you go, no, neither of those. And, oh, no, stop it. Okay, and we reject it because we don't think that. And the more you do that, if you reject that all the time, if somebody says you're lovely or whatever, and you go, no, I'm not. Well, you can imagine if you give somebody a gift and you thought a lot about this gift and you'd spent several weeks tracking it down and you spent a lot of money on it and you wrap it nicely and you go to the house and you go, hey, well, here's a gift. I've spent a lot of thought on it. And he goes, yeah, thanks. And then just carries on talking. You'd go, oh, well, I'm not going to buy him a gift again. And yet that's what we do when somebody tells us true stuff that we don't believe. We actually reject it and push them away. And when we do that, we don't have to do it many times before they stop doing it. So they don't tell us nice stuff anymore. And then we go back into going, yeah, even he doesn't like me and I'm married to him. Okay, so whatever we think about our life, we actually bring that into our life. And it's like the law of attraction. It just works in that way. Whether it's vibrational or what you put out there comes back. It doesn't really matter what you believe in. Because even with just the way your unconscious works, it tries to do everything it can for whatever you think about. So whatever you think about, the unconscious goes, oh, you would like that. And this is the one thing that can change everybody's life if they understand the unconscious mind does not understand negatives. So anything you ask for, if you ask it in the negative, I don't want this to happen, whatever you think about, it thinks you want that. Because it misses all the I don't want bits out, and you go to happen, and it tries to make that happen. And there's a really good explanation for this, and I'm so famous for it that people actually buy me chocolate biscuits, is the chocolate biscuit. Do you all like chocolate biscuits? Okay, so you sit on the settee one night and nothing on the telly, and then suddenly you get this, ooh, some chocolate biscuits in the cupboard, right? So I want you to, because you all like chocolate biscuits, I just want you to imagine now eating chocolate biscuit, right? So just feel the taste of it on your mouth, right? Even better if it's a hobnob, crunchy and everything else. So just get the flavour and the texture. And if I offered you a chocolate biscuit now, you'd really want one, wouldn't you? So you've actually instructed your brain to go, chocolate biscuits, they're really nice, I like them, oh yummy. Okay, but the next thought you have is, oh, chocolate biscuits, I really shouldn't be eating those. Okay, really shouldn't be eating a chocolate biscuit. Now the only bit your unconscious hears is chocolate biscuit. And it follows on from you going, oh, there's chocolate biscuits in the cupboard, and feeling good about yourself. So when you try and flip it on its head and you go, shouldn't eat the chocolate biscuit, it just goes, chocolate biscuit. And it's already excited. So you sit there and you think, oh, no, I mustn't eat the chocolate biscuit. And then you go, I mustn't eat the chocolate biscuits. I mustn't eat the chocolate biscuits. And then you're heading towards the kitchen going, I mustn't eat the chocolate biscuits. And as you get there, you're opening the cupboard, you go, I really shouldn't be eating these biscuits. And each time you're just reinforcing the fact that you want a chocolate biscuit and that you like them. And then as you start to eat them, you're already starting to feel guilty, but you're still going, it'll taste good and I'll enjoy it for a few moments, but I shouldn't be having it. And then you go, well, at least I haven't eaten the whole packet. Right. But no, but this is your conscious, this is your unconscious thought. You're talking to yourself and you're going, I shouldn't be eating these. I shouldn't eat the whole packet. So you're actually saying, eat the whole packet. And as you finish the last one of that packet, if you say to yourself, at least I didn't start the second packet, then the second packet comes out and you start on that. And, you know, you sort of carry on till you feel sick, really, don't you? I do, anyway. It's about me, this is really. So whatever we think of is what we attract into our life. And so we have this thing that it's not just chocolate biscuits, it's for everything in our life. If we think about the thing we don't want, we're actually going to attract that, because the unconscious will look for every way possible of solving the problem that you've given it. Right? Everything you ask for, the unconscious goes, oh, see if I can get that for you. Right? And so if you're in a relationship, for instance, and it's starting to get a bit stale, or you think it's going to end or whatever, and you go, oh, I hope it doesn't end, I really love him, but it's not very good anymore, and I really hope it doesn't end. Everything that you look at and see will be about, well, you know, should I get a place for myself? Should I throw him out? Who's going to get the cat? Who's going to get the dog? Who's going to get the car? Everything you're thinking about is about ending the relationship that you don't want to end. So if you flip it on its head, the exact opposite of ending a relationship is starting a relationship. And when you start a relationship, there's just something wonderful about that first few weeks, that honeymoon period of meeting somebody. At first you're not sure, but then there's this love and everything else. And then even stupid things that they do, like squeezing the toothpaste in the wrong place, and you go, oh, isn't that cute? And now they do it and you want to kill them, don't you? Murder! So we all have the little foibles that we have that we turn up with, and then we try and change the other person to go, oh, don't do that anymore, that's horrible, because I wouldn't do that. But if you start to think about, well, what was it like when we first got together, and you start behaving in that way, although you can only ever change yourself, you can't change anybody else, you can't force somebody else to change, they have to want to change to join in with that. Or you can nag them for like 10 years and they might change. Doesn't work though, does it? Because they fight against it. Whereas if you go back to the initial stages they were at and you behave in that way towards them, what you'll find is that will trigger off in their memory how they used to behave to you. And you'll start finding that they change how they are towards you. And then if there's any chance of saving that, that's the best you're ever going to do, is actually start to change the other person by how you change. There's a thing called going there first, and it's, let me just close that door for a second. There's a thing called going there first, and what it's about is that if you want anybody to behave in a certain way, you have to behave in that way as you tell them. Have you all got kids? Yeah? Kids? Oh, right. Well, you weren't nodding, so I should have noticed the resemblance. So when you have kids, you can't, just before bedtime, if you've got really small kids, and you go to them, oh, we're going to go to bed in a minute, oh, won't it be wonderful, you're going to go to bed and you're going to go to sleep, and then you put them in the cot or whatever, and they just look at you wide awake, all right? So we all know, naturally, that before you put a child to bed, you have to go, okay, we're going to bed in a few minutes, and it's going to be really nice and really gentle, and I might do you a little lullaby or read you a story, but you slow it right down, and you take them towards sleep, by you almost putting yourself to sleep at the same time. In fact, I regularly used to go up and see my wife asleep at the side of the bed with a book in hand and the kids wide awake still. She was too good at it. So if you want somebody to do something, you actually go there first. Now, I've seen a lot of these American cop programs, and because I like them, because it's just fun. And they chase the villain, and they get the villain pinned up against the wall, and he's not going anywhere, but he's been a violent character, all they know he's a violent character. And then they've sort of got the cuffs on and everything else, and they've got him pinned up the wall, and then they go, calm down, calm down, calm down. Well, if somebody said that to me in that tone of voice, I'd punch them. And I'm a very mild-mannered guy. So it's a really easy way of dealing with things, is if you get upset about something and then you challenge somebody on their behaviour, it's going to kick off. You know it's going to kick off because you're in kick-off mode and they join in with you. So however well you phrase it, they know you're spoiling for a fight and they join in with the fight because they react to it. Whereas if you deal with it, if you wait an hour until it's, you know, all calmed down a bit, and then you say, can I just have a chat about what happened earlier, please? And you deal with it calmly, then there's no need for this feedback. You know, you get the calm, well, you get a calmer response. You might not ever be able to, there's some people you can't sort of please, isn't there, in life, and we've all come across those. And so how it all works is, and I'm going to get on to love and joy in a minute, I could guarantee that, how your mind works is, it's divided into two ways of operating. One is the bit that we understand, it comes to mind. You hear the voice in your head or whatever, and you think about something and you make a choice between, you know, shall I go to this thing or shall I not? And that's the only reason we have a conscious mind, is so we're not animalistic, we're not just hunting for food or sex all the time, because that's all animals do. Or fight. Food, sex or fight. So we're not doing that because we can then choose to do things, and we can choose things like art and culture and everything else, because we have this thing that says, what do I want to do? And because food's readily available and everything, we have the time to do what we want to do. So we have a conscious mind, and it's because of that that we've got everything that we've created in the world. So the conscious mind seems to be the one that everybody thinks they're clever with. And it's not, because your conscious mind is really, really tiny. Not in proportions of the physical nature of it, but if I was to say how much it operates compared with the rest of your head, it would be like a little pinhead in your head. That little bit is how much it does. It's less than 0.0001%. Most of the things we do, we do because we were either born with a program to do it. So you're all here today, you've all lived this long, which means your heart's been going every second of the day, your lungs, your blood system, your pH balance in your stomach, everything about you has been running every second since the day you were born. I mean, we are little miracles in the fact that something as complex as the body is run by these programs that we've already got installed. And then we learn things from being born onwards. And the first 5 years of your life, I mean, they call them the formative years, is when we copy everybody else. So we see what goes on around us, and then we think, well, everybody seems to be stood on their 2 feet, and I'm just crawling around, so what's happening here? And then we start to emulate it. So eventually we get to the thing where we stand up, and then we've seen everybody else stand, so we then let go of things and we stand up for a short while, and then we fall over. And we keep doing it and keep doing it, keep doing it, until the automatic bit of the brain goes, ah, you've done it lots of times, I know what you want now. I can run that for you. And then it lets you walk. So from the stumbling steps that you first do, it then allows you to walk on any terrain you like. You can walk on rocky things, you can walk up hills, even though your feet are sloping now. And it adjusts everything. And it's the most technical thing we do is walking. Because when they try and get a robot to walk, they just can't do it. You know, it ends up with a really, if it's a flat surface, it's fine and everything. But they can't get it to walk or climb or do whatever. So our brain has this complex mechanism that allows it to adjust everything, but we have to keep repeat doing it to install the program. Now, walking in particular, you can try it as often as you like, and at no point when you fall over did your mum ever say, oh, stop that walking nonsense, you're never going to be able to do it. All right? There's no parent in the history of the world that's ever said, you're never going to get the hang of this, just stop it. Crawl around the rest of your life. Right? So we just keep doing things and we persevere until we get there. And it's reckoned that in the first 5 years, we learn 80% of everything we know about life. Absolutely everything, how it works and everything else. So if you think of all the education you've had since five and all the things you've learned about life, that only makes up 20% of what you know. So in those first 5 years, when you're observing everything, you don't particularly challenge it. You start challenging it from six onwards. Now, this might be getting younger each year, but from about six, you start going, why? Why, Mummy? Why? But she did, didn't she? Why, Mummy? And you answer it a few times, and then you get sick of it, and then you go, well, just because I said so. Right? But what they're trying to do is they're trying to understand the rules for it. Because up until five, they just observe it and they go, that's how life is. Right? That's how life will be for me. Now, if you're brought up in a warm and loving house, that's brilliant. Because that's what you expect from a relationship when you get older. You see your mum and dad together and everything's hunky-dory, that's fine. If your dad beats your mum up, or the other way around even, you start to think that's how a relationship is. And you expect that when you have a relationship. You don't want that, but you expect that because that's how they are. So you learn so many things in this first 5 years that you hang on to as, oh, that's how it is. And most of them aren't true. It's great if they are true. And some things we carry on and we keep developing them. So walking, you know, I'm 62 now, and if I got a dodgy leg, I would still be able to walk, but I'd have a limp. Because I would adjust the thing and I'd say, right, we used to do it like that quite normally, but now I've got this problem here and that's a bit tight, and I'd walk with a limp. So I'd adjust it, but I'd still be able to do it. And we do the same with language. We keep adding to language as we get older, we learn more about language and we use better language and we can express ourselves better. So all those things carry on working. But lots of the things we do are still locked into those first 5 years. And great if they're working. But if they're not, it's bad news. So when I deal with people with anxiety, I know it's not going to be as an adult that they got the anxiety. It's quite often that it's earlier on. They might remember something at 15 or 16 or whatever that, you know, was quite painful. But it's usually something earlier than that that actually sets them off to have this lack of self-worth. And then when something else comes along, that's the thing they remember. But sometimes it only happens because they had a lack of self-worth. So I met a woman who'd been gang raped at 13, and she phoned me up to tell me this and say, that'll be the problem, won't it? And I said, it might be. It's quite likely it is, but it might not be. And it wasn't. And something fairly trivial had happened to her at six, that when we looked at it as adults was trivial, and that had set her up to this thing that she wasn't worthy. And so when this gang of people came across her, it was sort of like, well, she's not going to tell anybody and she's not going to fight us, because she came across as a victim. So it was what happened to her at six that was the problem. It wasn't the 13-year-old. That was this six-year-old caused the 13-year-old problem. Right. I mean, it didn't bring it on her, but it made her open to it and open to the attack. So, with love, joy, you're born with all these things. Everything you could ever want, apart from material stuff, any emotion you could ever want, anything that you'd want for your life, is already inside you. You're born with it. And we're born very loving. Everybody seems to have a personality when they're born. So I don't know whether that's spirit or what. I don't know what your beliefs are. But kids just, they come out different to each other, don't they? And you can, if you have several kids, and I've got twin grandchildren, and there is a difference in chalk and cheese. And they just come out with this personality. So there's certain things you're born with. But in the main, we have this, there's an openness to everybody else. We don't divide anything by race or colour or anything like that. Put a mix of children in a room and they'll just play together. They don't notice any of that. And we have kind and loving hearts. And if you see kids playing, they'll fall out with each other and you'll separate them and go, don't go near that child again. 2 minutes later, they're together again, aren't they? Playing. they don't care. It's sort of like things happen in the moment, they react to it in the moment, and then they're back again going, well, a bit of fun, weren't we? Before we fell out, we had a bit of fun, so they go back to it again. And as adults, we tend to read too much into something that's happened. And we read too much into it because how we feel about a self is how we feel that other people feel about us. That sounds a bit complicated, doesn't it? The best I can explain this is I had a woman who came to see me on a regular basis. This wasn't for treatment or anything. She just became a friend of mine. And she came to me originally when it was weight loss that I did. And every week she came with a new tale of somebody who'd upset her or somebody she'd fallen out with, or there was always something going on. And she would explain in detail about this person and what they'd done and what they hadn't done and so on. And it didn't take long before I realised this is just her thinking that nobody likes her. And because she thought that, everything they ever said, she treated it as though, well, that's what they said, but what did they mean? And she would change the meaning of it, and then she would repeat back words as though this person had said it. And I kept twigging to this, and I kept sort of trying to correct her. And my view on this is, if you think that somebody else doesn't like you, then you actually just put that flavour to it. But it's not coming out of their head. You're trying to mind read what they think about you, but that's what you think about you. So if you think you're horrible, you'll think that they think you're horrible. If you don't have any self-worth and you can't love yourself, you can't imagine why anybody else would love you. And so that affects all of your life. And you just keep looking for the reinforcement of it. You don't look for the opposite of it, because you don't feel worthy of that love. And then we reject people, we push them away. But I'll come back to a rejection in a minute. So this woman kept telling me these tales, and eventually her father died, and she came a couple of weeks later, and she was quite distraught over it, obviously. But she'd been there at the time he died in the hospital, and she was going to sue the hospital and all this sort of thing. There's all sorts of things that went wrong. But he was diabetic and blind and two limbs missing, and it didn't have any quality of life, really. But she told me what the doctor said to her. And when she said it, it just didn't ring true. There was this sort of like, well, no doctor, 10 minutes after your father died, would say that to you. It just, no professional person in the world would say that. And so I just looked at this ring, and it was like, and I said, well, I don't want to sort of pull you up on this, but don't you think the doctor said... And I changed it all around to what would he most likely have said from the words that she repeated back. And then she thought for a few seconds. In fact, I said, he didn't say that. And she was like, wow. And I said, no, I bet he said. And I changed it round, and she said, well, that's what he said, but what I said is what he meant. She just kept twisting everything around. And then she used to say to me, I know what you're thinking now. And I go, well, you don't. Because, and this is the language I use with my clients, you shit as a mind reader. You just shit at it. And she was. She was absolutely awful at it. She never got it right. And I said, so if you're thinking what you think any normal person would think, you're wrong. Because I'm a therapist. So when I listen to people, I'm not actually worried about what they're telling me, or I'm not judging them or going, oh, you're horrible if you think that. I'm just listening to what they say to try and find the answer. So even when people tell me real distressing tales, like the woman who'd been gang raped, I don't need the detail anyway, and I don't get distressed by that, because that wouldn't help her if I got distressed as well. So I listen to it, but, is that the reason for it? How can I help her with it? So I'm not bugged by it after they've left, because I'm just looking at that for that reason. So we had this conversation, and every week I used to correct her on, but that's you rubbish at mind reading. And I said, that's just you thinking that you don't like yourself and reflecting it back. And she started to take notice of me after several weeks. But a few weeks after that, she came in, a big grin on her face, and went, I can prove you wrong. And I went, oh, can you? Sit down. And I said, come on then, what's happened? And she said, well, this woman the other day told me I was horrible. So that's not me thinking I'm horrible and translating it into their head and then getting it back. She actually told me I was horrible. And I went, oh, okay. I said, just for a minute, let's talk about your best friend. I said, that one that's really nice. I didn't know one. I just said, you've got a really nice friend, haven't you? She said, yeah. I said, the nicest friend you've got. Just think of the nicest friend you've got. And she went, yeah. I said, would they ever say anything horrible about anybody? And she said, no. I said, that's why they're a nice person, isn't it? So nice people only ever say nice things about people, don't they? Yeah. Where are we going with this? And I said, well, the woman that told you you were horrible is not a nice person, is she? Because if she was nice, she'd only say nice things about you. So she must be horrible. So whose head did that come out that you're horrible? She said, hers. So I said, so who's horrible? She said, she is. I went, so why am I wrong? And it is, whatever we think people are going to say, or if we expect a row at work or whatever, we go in with that attitude of, you know, there's going to be a row, and even if you're nervous about it, you're still in the rowing mode. And so if that person then says something nice to you, you analyse it and go, ooh, just a minute, was that a backhanded, you know, you're looking slim in that today, or do I normally look fat? And everything they say, you will change into this thing that they're always trouble. These people are always trouble, they don't like me anyway, they're going to try and get me out. So when they do say something nice, you just won't accept it. And we start to reject people on these things. So we're rejecting them anyway. So if they tell us something nice and we just, oh, not me, we're rejecting them. So eventually they stop telling you anyway. And we start to push people away. And if we have this thing of, I'm not of any value and why would anybody love me? If we can push them away, there's some sort of satisfaction in going, I knew they didn't love me. And it's really weird. And it becomes self-fulfilling then, because then you go, well, he didn't love me and I, you know, nobody loves me. How could anybody love me? So I'll never find anybody. And then anybody who comes along that shows you the slightest bit of affection, you go, well, I wonder why he wants me. Is it just after the one thing, you know, will he really love me? So if I tell you the tale of the young lad that's in an orphanage, and he gets to about 11, and nobody's ever took him anywhere else. He's just lived in his orphanage all his life. And a couple turn up and they go, little Johnny, we love you. We're going to take you to our house and you're going to live with us. And we're going to adopt you. And he goes, but you can't love me. You've only met me twice. And they go, no, we love you. And we're going to take you home. So they take him home. And the first day he does something quite naughty. And he just wants to test that they love him. So he does something naughty and, you know, floods the kitchen or something, and they sort of, oh, that's a bit naughty, you know, let's sit down, let's have a chat about this. And he goes, well, you don't love me. No, we really love you, you've just been a bit naughty. And each day he gets more and more naughty. And he's just testing them. Will you still love me if I'm this naughty? Will you still love me if I'm this naughty? So one day he finally sets fire to the house. And they're all stood outside in their pyjamas and everything while the house burns down. And he goes, do you love me now? And they go, yes, we still love you, but you've got to go back to the orphanage because we'd all like to be able to sleep in our beds at night. And off he goes back to the orphanage and he smiles because he knows that anybody who loves you rejects you. And that now fits in with his belief. So he's quite happy to be back at the orphanage. And that's what we all do. We get things that fit in with our belief and then we go, yeah, I don't like it, but yeah, that fits in with my belief. That doesn't make me feel uncomfortable. We're comfortable in being rejected and things. So, how do you get to love and joy in your life? Well, you're born with all these things, and you have them there. Now, a lot of people say to me, oh, well, you know, I'm never going to go out with anybody again, never going to have another relationship, I've had my heart broken, and I'm not doing that anymore. And what you do with a broken heart is, the heart breaks open and then you seal it up and you weld it shut and it's not available to anybody, including you. And you die a little. and you stay dead because you've sealed it all off. And the purpose of having love and joy is to give it away. That's its only purpose in life. If we give love and joy away, we get it back. Not necessarily from the same person you gave it to. And it's very much like a smile that you give to somebody in the street. Somebody smiles at you in the street and you, what was that about? And then you smile. And if you smile as you're going past somebody, they smile. And suddenly that one smile turned into 10 smiles across the day. Or if somebody rushed you up to you in the street, and I always wanted to do this when I was younger, but I thought I might get my face slapped. I wanted to buy some bunches of flowers and just give them out randomly to women. And just go, I think you deserve this, and just give them to them. But like, what would the reaction be? The bloody hell's up with you. But I just wanted to do that, just to say to somebody, you know, you've got a nice smile, or you're looking good today, or you look like a very lovely person, and just give them a bunch of flowers and walk off. So they know it's not about anything else, just that I'd give them a gift. I might do it. I might do it. Okay, so if we seal our heart up, we're actually just locking that hurt in, and we lock it in forever. I have a thing now that I do that is about unconditional love. I have unconditional love for everybody, absolutely everybody. And even people that everybody finds annoying, somehow, because I have unconditional love now, it doesn't annoy me at all. I've got a client at the moment who suffered from depression. And I took her from suicidal to, you know, 0 out of 10 to an 8 out of 10 in the same day. But what I hadn't realised was that she wouldn't have the skills to deal with certain things. So I've been in touch with her ever since, trying to build up those skills as well. And she sends very annoying texts, or things that most people find annoying texts, and it's like, I'm worthless. And it's sort of, how do you respond to that? Because you go back and you go, no, you know, I like you, you're a really nice person. And they go, no, you don't. And then you end up with several text messages before you, and sometimes I even swear at her in a text. And strangely, that brings out a sense of humour in her. And then she goes, oh, okay then. It's really weird. But lots of people wouldn't have the stamina to keep responding to that and getting rejected. But because I have unconditional love, I don't see rejection. To me, I'm just giving out love. If people want to accept it, they can accept it. If they don't want it, it's their odd luck. It doesn't matter. And because I give unconditional love all the time to everybody, I get it from so many different directions. And it just comes back in. But it comes back bigger than it went. Which now means I've got far more love and joy than I need, so I give it away more. And then I get more back. And it keeps going on like that. And I'm going to take you through, if you'd like to do a little exercise with me, would you like to do that? Where you send love and joy out into the world and then you get it back? So you can actually feel this? Okay, are you all right to do that, all three of you? Okay. I've never had such a big audience before. Just you, little one. So, I did this, sorry.
I'm coming for the 12 o'clock one.
Okay. What time is it?
I've just gone 10 to 12.
All right. I'll be out in a few minutes. Right. Well, we probably won't have time for this exercise then. But I'm doing a talk at 2 o'clock if you want to come back and we'll do a similar exercise. Okay. The exercise I do, I literally sit down. I did it in an event like this that was a bit quiet one day, and nobody was walking around. I thought, I'll just do this. Didn't do it for any particular reason. I sat down on a chair, and all I do is I start to think about somebody who I have unconditional love for, like my parents, or my children, or my grandchildren, and then I feel where that movement is inside, and then I just think about expanding it, until I can't hold it in my body anymore, and then I expand it around the world. And then I feel like, with a smile, that everybody it touches, it warms them up and they send out love. And so in the end, there's 7 billion people on the planet all sending out love to each other. And then it comes back and it comes back into you. And it's a really wonderful feeling. So I'm so embarrassed that we've run out of time because it's lovely. And so I did this, sent all this love out, and then it came back into me and I'm tingling all over, and I open my eyes and I'm just coming back into the room, and Trudy walked into my life, my lovely girlfriend there, and we've been together for a year and 3 months now. And it's the most fantastic relationship I've ever had. And that just came from allowing love out and allowing it back in. It just changes things. It just, come on in. No, come on in. Yeah, you need to get ready and change over and everything. Okay, thanks. So, anyway, I've been Stephen Blake. You've been a lovely audience. Please come see me on the stand if there's anything you want to chat about. I'm either giving sessions at 20 minutes today, or there's a free chat if you just want to discuss anything that you've might have been triggered off by today. Thank you very much. You're allowed to applause if you like. More than that. Thank you.